The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live inside Studio West where the rain comes down, down, down. I'll kvetch about that a little bit later. Let me tell you, I've got a great show today. Senator Tom Cotton is coming by, Byron York, Olivia Beavers, regular contributors to what's going on in Congress. I'm also going to be joined by Greg Laurie. Greg Laurie is at the center of the movie The Jesus Revolution because at the time he was 17 and became a member of Chuck Smith's church as is profiled in The Jesus Revolution. The Jesus Revolution has made $45 million. I'm just blown away by this. So Greg is coming up at the end of the show today. And a lot of news in between and your phone calls. There was no arrest yesterday of President Trump. I'm going to run through the news here. But I want to tell all of you, special edition of the Highly Concentrated Hugh podcast. I know that's the free podcast. That's a few part of the radio show. And we condense it and we put it into 30 to 45 minutes. But today, at the end of it, because the grand old pod today is so fabulous. The Grand Old Pod is normally behind the paywall. You have to be a subscriber to the universe. On Monday and Wednesdays, I host it. On Tuesdays, former Congressman John Campbell's in with Generalissimo. On Wednesdays, James Lilex from the Minneapolis Star Tribune is in with Generalissimo. And then Ed Morrissey and Dwayne do cleanup work on Friday. So 5 days a week, exclusive content over at the universe. And today I'm going to put that onto Highly Concentrated You. If you're already a subscriber, be a subscriber to both of them. Let's go to the news. Xi and Putin bind China and Russia's economies further despite war in Ukraine. Nothing major came out of the public announcements of the Xi-Putin summit, but the body language and everything else is ominous for the West. That is an alliance. It is all the hallmarks of an alliance. There was a little debate online last night. Well, this is just another meeting between world leaders. No, 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 no. It is an alliance between the most ruthless man in the world, Xi Jinping, and the most brutal man in the world, Putin. And they are aligned with a religious fanatic, Khamenei, in Iran. And that's the new axis of evil. That's the 2.0 version. And it's the one you ought to, and they got a proxy state in North Korea as well. But those three are the big deals. And they are like the Pact of Steel from the 30s. That happened. They've left. They've gone back to their countries. Be aware. Just pay attention. We'll talk with Senator Cotton about that. Just before the show came on, the Bundesbank chief, that is the Jerome Powell of Germany, his name is Joachim Nagel, he told the Financial Times after he and other members of the European Central Bank's Governing Council got together that, quote, our fight against inflation is not over. He said the central banks must be stubborn. All right, that's Volcker speak for we're going to screw you until the economy stops cooking too much. And that means we got to have some layoffs. We got to have some bankruptcies. We got to shake out the irrational exuberance. And that is indeed going to happen. And today we're going to get an interest rate hike from Jerome Powell. You're going to be a quarter point or a half point. If it's a quarter point, the market won't know what to do. If it's a half point, the market will reel backwards. If it's nothing, the market will celebrate. But don't look for that because 6% inflation is not acceptable. Donald Trump was not indicted yesterday, as he had told us he would be over the weekend. And so the New York Times, because they want to sell newspapers, and Maggie Haberman and Michael Bender are never not going to write about Trump. Their headline, Trump at Mar-a-Lago, magical thinking in a perp walk, fixation. Donald Trump claims he is ready for his perp walk. Behind closed doors at Mar-a-Lago, the former president has told friends and associates that he welcomes the idea of being paraded by authorities before a throng of reporters. I'm sure the former president will tell us that's fake news today. Donald Trump is rallying people to his cause as the arrest appears to be imminent, and he wants demonstrations. Kevin McCarthy, interviewed in Orlando, where the Republican retreat was coming to a conclusion, said, look, we're unified. There are some tests looming on spending cuts. There will be some fallout from any political prosecution of Donald Trump. But generally, the Republicans are getting done what they want to get done. And I know that to be true. He's turning out to be the excellent speaker we expected him to do. The emphasis is oversight, 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 and we need some debt reduction. We need some spending, fiscal restraint from President Biden. who has not met with Kevin McCarthy in 5 weeks. So the Republicans are waiting for the president to get serious about the debt limit. And he wants some brinksmanship because the disasters on his watch are just growing ever more present. Today is TikTok Day on the Hill. All right. So we've got Shuzi Chu is going to testify today on why TikTok isn't a menace. Well, TikTok is a menace. And we know it's a menace. And the Wall Street Journal reports that TikTok reassures advertisers over the ban that is threatened. You can't reassure advertisers because TikTok is an engine of the Chinese Communist Party. It's that simple. And the dossier they are collecting on you and your children, if you use it, and what the malware they may have inserted into your system, they may be listening to you right now. Do not underestimate what the Chinese communists do, and they're doing it through TikTok. But the New York Times cautions pulling the plug on TikTok will be a lot harder than it looks. Today, I have a Washington Post column on the fact that the way social media operates has obliged all of us to live in a maelstrom, a continual avalanche of terrible news. The sort of stuff you used to hear maybe in a monthly phone call home or in an exchange of letters or a glimpse of something you heard from someone, you hear about bad news person to person, that's been replaced by this avalanche of bad news that comes into people's Facebook feeds, their Instagram feeds, their Twitter feeds every single day, along with conflict. And my post essay is pretty long, but it talks about sports as the diversion from this reality of omnipresent misery. And there's also a manifestation on social media of living in the muck all the time. I encourage you to go over to the Washington Post. I may read it in segment three today. But it combines, I wrote it before it'd been edited. It's in today's paper before Danny Lewis wrote in the Wall Street Journal this morning. A psychologist explains how AI and algorithms are changing our lives. All right. I didn't read this because nobody knows. Nobody knows. All we know for sure, right, the one data point is that it's making teenage girls miserable. And they are sort of the canary in the coal mine. Extrapolate from that it's making everybody miserable. Why is it making everyone miserable? Because they're wallowing in terrible news and misery. And they should be praying for people who are suffering. But there's a lot of bad stuff going on in America. I run through the numbers. There are 13,000 people with ALS. One out of 44 children are on the spectrum. 6 million people have Alzheimer's. 1 million people have Parkinson's. 1 million people have MS. You learn about this, sudden death occurs, cancer occurs, and you marinate it, and it changes your worldview. And so the Wall Street Journal has noticed. I mentioned to you that the big question for the Fed is how much to raise interest rate, but there's a second one. It's in the New York Times today. What went wrong with bank oversight? Now, I'm going to say a lot more about this, but bank oversight is being conducted by bureaucrats. Now, Federal Reserve bureaucrats are slightly different from Federal Civil Service bureaucrats, but they're still bureaucrats. They're banking bureaucrats. And they don't see things right in front of them because bureaucrats never do. That's not the job of bureaucrats, to be nimble, to be intellectually curious, to be zipping around and anticipating problems. They do the same thing again and again and again. And when banks fail, it's not regulatory failure. It's usually regulatory capture, meaning that the regulators have seduced the regulators into loving them. If that's not SCB and Signature, I don't know what is. The chalet, the meetings, the advertising, the ubiquity of being part of the deal, being wined and dined in Silicon Valley, it's just hypnotic for bank examiners. And it happened to the Fed. Good economic news. Home prices fell in February for the first time in 11 years. All right, so they actually fell by a little bit. And that's not because homes are less valuable. It's because fewer people bought them, and those that are new to the market, they had a little negotiating leverage. Now, that's not true in don't get your hopes up if you're trying to buy a house in Southern California or Boston or Florida. The markets are, but just a little bit of an ease back. Asia's investors were bushwhacked by something they did with Credit Suisse. Like bondholders in GM during 2008, they just screwed the Credit Suisse bond wipeout, $17 billion. And in L.A., 420,000 students entered the second day of a strike. I really cannot believe after COVID, after the teacher unions demanded strikes of 2 years ago, that we've got picket lines in front of schools because the Service Employees International Union, and that would be the cafeteria, they're good people. They work hard, bus drivers, cafeteria workers, janitors. But putting 420,000 kids out of school when it's raining like this, just nuts. Just nuts. And remember, that's union behavior. Support school choice. We were helpless, disparate, the CDC as the pandemic erupted. More on that coming up. Google launches its own chatbot, Bard. It's its own AI, artificial intelligence. And a little update from the Ukraine. That's all coming ahead on segment two. Stay right where you are. The Wednesday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show rolls along right here on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I'm Hugh Hewitt. My guest is United States Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas. Good morning, Senator Cotton. Welcome.
Good morning, Hugh. It's good to be on with you.
You know, we have created, since you're always in the car and we can't put you on camera, we have created a new B-roll of you over at the Salem sent me B-roll. And they said, whenever you talk to Senator Cotton, show this B-roll. And I'm sure Jacob is running around trying now to put it up on the Salem News Channel. I'm not sure what we have in that B-roll. I really have no idea. It could be very flattering or it could be terrible. What do you think? What do you think we grab for our B-roll?
I suspect if you're in charge of it, it's not very flattering. But if anyone on your very fine staff who helps keep this program afloat somehow, I'm sure it's great.
Well, before long, we'll be running it, and people who are watching on the Salem News Channel will be able to see it. Go find it, Jacob. Senator Cotton, I want to start with the biggest story of the week, the month, and the year. Xi and Putin together again in Moscow. Now, the Pact of Steel didn't come around until 1938. Mussolini and Hitler started getting around together in the mid-30s. How ominous is that gathering and the cementing of that alliance in your eyes?
Well, it's very worrisome, Hugh. I want to be clear, Joe Biden didn't bring these two together. They are anti-American dictators who want to overturn an American-led global order of security and stability that serves our interests and replace it with one that serves their interests. However, Joe Biden's weakness in his first 2 years in office have created what they see as new opportunities for advancing their shared interests, whether it was the appeasement of China and Russia both early in the administration, the fiasco in Afghanistan, or now Joe Biden's halting half measures in Ukraine. Time and again, Joe Biden has encouraged these two anti-American dictators to act on their long shared interests in undermining America's national security and the global order that advances America's interests as opposed to the anti-American interests of countries like China and Russia and others.
Now, I add Iran in as part of the terrible three, but I think Beijing is the capital of this. There has been a debate inside the Republican Party. Too much weight is being put on your friend Ron DeSantis' use of the term territorial dispute, which may have been inartful, but was hardly a policy statement. You're friends with everyone in the Republican Party. You are the hawk's hawk. What are you telling everyone, left, right, and center in the Republican Party? Isolationist to full-on Iraq war invasion was a good idea. What are you telling them all about right now?
Right now is a very dangerous moment, in part because so many of our friends around the world question whether or not America will uphold our security commitments, will defend our interests, as opposed to continuing to appease and conciliate and kowtow to Beijing in particular, but also adversaries as well. Like you mentioned, Iran. I was just in the region last month, and there are serious questions about whether America will not only defend our friends in the region, but even defend ourselves. If you look at the number of attacks that have been launched against Americans who are in places like Iraq, for instance, by Iran, without any retaliation for those Iranian provocations. So you see cases where not only anti-American dictators are coming together to forge stronger partnerships to undermine America's interests, but even friendly nations like Saudi Arabia have normalized their diplomatic relations with Iran for the first time since 2016 in a deal that was brokered by Beijing. It's pretty remarkable that we came out of President Trump's administration hoping for a peace deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia, and what we got was a diplomatic normalization between Iran and Saudi Arabia brokered by China.
Yeah, it's very bad news, and that passed almost unremarked upon, and it suggests a fraying of our traditional pillar in the Middle East, Israel and Saudi Arabia, backed up by UAE and other friendly country. Senator Cotton, in terms of you're a lawyer and you're on the Judiciary Committee, when you see Americans lecturing Israelis on what to do with their court system, do you respond as I do, which is it's none of our business? That's a domestic issue. We should not be hectoring them on either way. But if you're going to hector, at least be consistent with your position taken in the United States. And the left is not doing that.
No, Hugh, again, I was in Israel last month. I was very clear about this at the time. I'm entirely confident that Israelis of all political persuasions can manage their own domestic affairs. They don't need the help of America to manage their own domestic affairs. They do need the help of America, however, to help broker peace agreements with their Arab neighbors, as we saw with the Abraham Accords under President Trump. They do need help to counteract the common terrorist threat that threatens both our nations, and they certainly need help to counteract the Iranian nuclear threat. That's what Israel needs America's help to do. They don't need American politicians meddling in their own domestic affairs. I will point out, however, that you are correct, that the Democrats who are lecturing Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition are saying the exact opposite about our Supreme Court and our court systems. Or for that matter, they are totally quiet when, for instance, Emmanuel Macron uses emergency powers to bypass his legislature after it rejected his pension reform bill and unilaterally impose it on the French people. And you have massive strikes and massive protests all across France. Yet where is Joe Biden? Where are liberal Democrats protesting Emmanuel Macron, supporting the workers in France? Again, I have no opinion on pension reform in France. I'm confident the French can manage their own internal affairs. However, it's just another example of the double standard that liberals apply to Israel and to no other nation.
The progressive critique of Benjamin Netanyahu, it's so maddening to me, not because it's right or wrong. I don't know. I don't really understand. Michael Oren says it needs to be fixed, but he doesn't like the fix. Everyone, they campaigned on it. They won. But I can't believe the number of Americans lining up to tell Israel what to do with their Supreme Court when in this country they want to pack the court by expanding the court. It's just simply mind-boggling. It's also maddening that the media doesn't cover its own consistency here, Senator.
Well, I mean, Hugh, unfortunately, it's of a piece with where liberal Democrats in this country have trended for a long time, going back 30 or 40 years. I mean, support for Israel used to be strongly bipartisan. But, you know, going back 30 years, really to the beginning of the Oslo process, support among Democrats for Israel simply declined. There's no two ways about it. Recent Gallup poll shows that a plurality of Democrats are now more sympathetic to the Palestinians than they are to the Israelis. By contrast, Republicans and independents are more supportive than Israel than ever. How that manifests itself comes out in different ways, but this is one example of it, is this double standard that liberals have always applied to Israel. You know, they'll criticize the Israeli government's judicial reform bill at the same time you say they're trying to pack the Supreme Court. They criticize the Israeli government because they have protesters showing up in the streets in large numbers. They don't criticize their bud Emmanuel Macron in France, who has protesters showing up in the streets in large numbers.
That's so well put.
The same thing at the United Nations.
Yeah. Now, let me conclude with Republican politics, Senator, because as I said at the beginning, you're on good terms with everyone. You're in Switzerland. You've done events for Ron DeSantis. I don't know if you've been with Chris Sununu in New Hampshire, but you're good friends with Glenn Youngkin, and one of your best pals is Mike Pompeo, and the former president gets along. You get along with them all. What do you want them to read besides only The Strong, your new book? What do you want them to be aware of as the most pressing set of issues they need to be addressing to our primary electorate in the Republican primary?
Well, Hugh, I'm very glad that you put a plug in for Only the Strong. I would recommend they read that if they want to hear 100 years of failures of progressive foreign policy and also a blueprint for how we can help rebuild American power and restore our economic and our military primacy in the world. You know, I think there's no better guide for the future than understanding more about the past. So I'm a reader of biographies and histories myself. If you understand how great statesmen have faced similar problems in the past, you can understand how it got in the future. You know, any of the books you and Larry Arnn have been talking about in your Churchill series on Churchill as writer over the last 6 months would be a fantastic read for any of these people who are seeking to lead our nation. I'd also recommend, if you want something more contemporary, Benjamin Netanyahu's memoirs.
Oh, yes.
How to be a clear, consistent leader of passion and conviction to speak to the moral sense of public opinion, to the vital national interests that leaders see for their nations. I just think understanding how our leaders in similar situations have handled challenges helps any leader tackle challenge today. Because, of course, that's a fundamental premise of conservatism, is that you and I are no different from our founding fathers, or no different from the people we read about in Jesus' time, or no different from the Israelites who were held in captivity in Egypt. I mean, human nature is the same. It's unchanging. It faces the same challenges today that it did 4,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago or 200 years ago. And that's why we can learn from history.
Last and quick question, Senator. You've been to the Middle East and you've gone as a soldier and transported a soldier way, and you've gone as a sitting senator. Which is the better way to travel to the Middle East?
Not being packed into an aircraft with 60 pounds of kit and a rifle and a helmet with the rest of your battalion, I have to say, is probably a little more comfortable, however you get there. I've gotten there a lot of different ways, but traveling with the full battalion of infantry soldiers is a little tight quarters.
I was just thinking about this week. The guy was on a Kodel to Israel, and I'll bet you that the transportation, the lodging was just a bit different between when Senator Cotton went to Iraq with the 101st Airborne or to Afghanistan and when he went to Israel this past month. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back. Thank you, Senator Cotton. More ahead on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
This is for all lonely people thinking that life has passed them by. Don't give up until you.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Drink from the silver cup.
Welcome back, America. To you and Inside Studio West, live on this Wednesday. Standing by waiting for Pastor Greg Laurie, and my guess is he's asleep. This is what happens with West Coast guests, is that they commit to doing it and they forget, and they don't set their alarm, and they check their calendar when they wake up, and then they're going to hit the middle of their forehead, and Greg's going to call me and say to me, I'm sorry. But I don't mind, because Greg Laurie changed my life, not because he had a revival where I accepted Christ, but because he agreed to let me do a documentary about him in 1992. I had been 5 years on the radio, or 3 years on the radio, and had been a couple of months into Life and Times, which was a nightly news and public affairs show that I co-hosted with Pat Morrison, Kermit Alexander, and Ruben Martinez. And one of the producers of that show, Martin Burns, came to me and he said, "Yeah, we're driving back and forth to LA every day and doing this 5 nights a week and doing it for." You know, it's a big deal to do nightly television, but they decided they want to do some documentaries. I said, Hugh, would you like to do a documentary? And Saul Gonzalez, I believe, is the one who suggested, why don't we do one on Greg Laurie and the Harvest Crusade? Because it's coming up. So it's the summer of 1992. And I said, who's Greg Laurie and what's the Harvest Crusade? And I've never been to an evangelical event and I didn't know Greg. And they said, well, every year, this young pastor, because this is 30 years ago, this young pastor leads the Harvest Crusade at Angel Stadium, and he packs it out for 4 nights, and then they move around the country, Billy Graham style, doing revivals. And I thought, oh, that ought to be interesting. I wonder what the shtick is. Because I have spent a lot of time interviewing religious leaders in the course of my radio work in the first 3 years. But this is still, it's 1992. I went on the radio in 1990. So 3 years of radio and a few months of television. I haven't talked to that many pastors, that many spiritual leaders. And that sounds good. We can take a camera crew, do a 3-camera shoot, go to the, we'll get lots of visuals in Anaheim Stadium. Generalissimo, have you been to Anaheim Stadium for Harvest Crusade ever?
Oh, absolutely. I've been there as a attendee. I have been there as a radio person. I have done remotes from there with Duffy several times. I've interviewed Greg Laurie from there before.
Well, Greg's your friend too. So
he's my pastor.
Yeah. So I roll in 1992, and Greg is he's wonderful on camera. All right. So he knows that all you have to be is yourself. Don't be aware of the camera. And we had a great documentary. In fact, Life and Times rarely got a one share. Okay, one share was for PBS, a big deal. We got a two share. We more than doubled our normal audience, and the folks in D.C. noticed that, and they said, what is this Greg Laurie documentary you did on the Harvest Crusade? And it led to Searching for God in America, which was a national series that was not the same but related to Greg Laurie, which led to the syndication show and going on and guest hosting for Duffy and meeting you, and it eventually became the Hugh Hewitt Show in July of 2020, and we've been doing it for 23 years since.
2000.
So for 23 years, we've been doing this, and it's all Greg Laurie's fault. Now, Greg Laurie may or may not want to take responsibility for the Hugh Hewitt Show, but it is all his fault. A lot of people have to own up. It's your fault because you brought me into guest host for Duffy. It's Ed Atzinger and Stu Epperson and Russ Hout and Russ Shubin. And there are a whole bunch of
and
people.
And it's actually Chuck Smith's fault.
That
Duffy got on the air to begin with.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, people don't know who Duffy is in New Hampshire. Tell people who Duffy was.
Duffy used to be an FM jock on KMET before he became a Christian. And then he had a consulting company, and he was repping all sorts of different bands and Christian artists and whatever, and KKLA came calling and said, hey, we want you to do this afternoon talk show. So he went to Chuck Smith, who was his pastor at the time at Calvary Chapel, Big Calvary, and he made an appointment, knocked on the door, went in, sat down with Chuck, and he said, okay, so this is the opportunity is presented in front of me, and here's my list of reasons for it, and here's my list of reasons against it. And his list of reasons against it was a mile long. And Chuck's just got this big smile on his face. And Duffy says, didn't you hear what I said? Here's all the reasons why I can't do this show. And Chuck says, well, you got to do it. And he says, why? And Chuck says, because you don't want to go through the rest of your life wondering if you missed God's call in your life. And Duffy went on to be
wildly successful. He also went on to be an archetype that we have modeled in every Christian teaching and talk station that Salem owns. There is an afternoon or a morning local host who does a combination of current events, politics, and gospel talk. And how long did you produce Duffy for?
Just over 5 years.
I don't know that Warren has forgiven me yet, because when the conservative talk side of Salem offered me this gig, the first thing I did was go to Dwayne and ask him if he'd be a producer, against my better judgment, because I knew he didn't produce Duffy either. And Dwayne said, well, you got to talk to Duffy. And I said, I can handle Duffy. And I took Warren out to lunch, and I said, Warren, I want to hire your producer, which is a better way of doing it. When Tony Snow tried to hire Dwayne, he didn't call me. And I love Tony Snow, so I forgave him.
There's Greg Laurie.
Someone woke him up. All right. What happens is somebody's driving around in Southern California and somebody said, Greg, you're supposed to be on the Hugh Hewitt Show. And so, you know, I'm very forgiving of guests on the West Coast who, you know, it's before dawn and it's raining and they're gloomy and grumpy. And I assume that's Greg Laurie, or it's somebody calling on his behalf to apologize for his sleeping through the alarm. And I don't care. We'll do it another time. What I want you to do is go see The Jesus Revolution. And I want you to, it's a very well-made movie. And Kelsey Grammer plays Chuck Smith, who I never had the advantage of meeting in person, but I interviewed him on the air. And the Calvary Chapel movement, and there are Calvary Chapels everywhere, expositional, it's a style. It's an approach. It's neo-fundamentalist, I would say. It's basically, here's what scripture says. Let me relate it to your life. Here's some worship songs. And it's a very well-tested, very productive way for people to meet Christ and understand. And then when they get more serious, they become Catholic. Because as Al Mohler said, people who go from evangelicalism to Catholicism are looking for an answer to everything. And they got to go eventually to the Summa Theologica and they get it. But in the meantime, Greg has fed, housed, clothed, done so many good things for so many people for so many years that when this movie came up, oh, Greg Laurie, how are you, my friend? I've been singing your praises for the last 10 minutes.
What's that again?
I said I've been singing your praises for your kindness to me in 1992. I had no idea you would be a movie star, sort of.
Well, not really. You know, it's an interpretation of my life, you know, as done by John Irwin, the director, but it's been a surprise to all of us.
It's astonishing, Greg. $45 million in box office for Lionsgate, their biggest grossing movie since the last decade. And it ain't going anywhere. I think it's going to continue as word of mouth spreads. What do your friends tell you? Is it going to maintain or hold close to the number of theaters it's playing in right now?
Well, you know, they're putting it international as well. It's going to be released in Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia as well, and Singapore. And so that might even expand more. And then, you know, when it hits streaming in mid-April, it'll reach its largest audience in Blu-ray. So, you know, they tell me it could reach upwards of 100 million people when it's all said and done. So it's just kind of staggering, because it took me basically 30 years of speaking live in stadiums to reach around 6 million people, and we've already surpassed that number. So it's just incredible, you know, what a movie can do, because it reaches so many people on so many levels, and so many interesting people from different backgrounds have reached out to me and told me they've seen the film. And I think the most exciting thing, Hugh, isn't just the box office, and we're thankful for that, because that's an indication of success. But the thing that's exciting to me is how people are having their lives impacted by it, and how it's spiritually strengthening them and even bringing people to faith in Jesus Christ.
Now, Greg, I want to go back to the beginning. Your life story is narrated in the movie The Jesus Revolution. I've heard it a number of times, and I made my first documentary about Greg Laurie doing the Harvest Crusade in 1992. Did you, when they approached you about doing this movie, were you skeptical? Because I honestly would not have invested in a movie about the Jesus Revolution. It's a 1971 Time magazine cover, which I remember quite distinctly. And you're my friend, but I still wouldn't have invested in it, because who is going to go see a movie about hippies in 1971? Turns out millions of people. So when they pitched you on it, what did you say?
Great question. Well, that's exactly what happened. So John Irwin, who ended up writing the screenplay and directing it, came to me literally with that Time magazine cover with the psychedelic image of Jesus. And it says Jesus Revolution. And John says, someone told me you were at this. You were alive during this time and experienced it. And I wanted to talk to someone who was there. So we talked for hours, and then we became friends. And he said he wanted to make a movie about it. And I was sort of, you know, skeptical that it would ever happen. And I was surprised when he gave me his first version of the screenplay, and he had taken my life and my wife's life, Kathy, as well as the life of Chuck Smith, the pastor of Calvary Chapel, and Lonnie Frisbee, this hippie evangelist, and wove our stories all together. And when I read that script, and I found myself choking up at times, I thought, this is going to touch people, because it wasn't just about an event. It's about people, and people relate to people. And there's so many narratives woven into this movie from my search for God leading me in the wrong directions through drugs, et cetera. Chuck Smith's, you know, failing church and his willingness to open his heart to something he didn't understand. That was the youth culture, to the story of a young version of me with his mother who was an alcoholic in her sad life, to even the dynamics of Kathy's relationship with her father and how he didn't understand what was happening to her after she believed. There's so many little hooks, if you will, or parts of the story that seem to touch people. And the one thing I hear over and over again, Hugh, is people saying to me, I cried through the whole movie, and how entertained they were, but how moved they were. And I think what's really exciting is how many young people are being reached by this, and how young people are loving this movie, not just people from my generation sort of having a deja vu moment.
That's important for me to understand. This is not a deja vu movie, though I enjoyed it. I want to talk about one technical thing. You're recreating 1971. I thought the movie would fall flat, because it's very hard to make period pieces accurate. This is on the nose. And if you were, I was in high school in 1971, as you were, and many of these scenes were shot at Newport Harbor High School. I thought you went to Corona Del Mar High School. I'm not sure, but I worked
at both.
Okay. So I went to St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church on Sunday with my wife. And I said, by the way, there's the set for part of of the Jesus Revolution, and boy, their attention to detail was remarkable. I don't know where they found the clothes or the cars, Greg, but they got it right.
Well, it was, you know, it was produced by Lionsgate, which is a major film studio, and they had a gigantic wardrobe department. They had everything. They had hair. They had makeup. They had all these trailers set up. It was like a little city. So I was pretty amazed. And here's the magic of a movie. That scene you saw at Harbor High School was actually filmed in Alabama.
Wow.
But they found a school that looked just like Harbor. And I was there when they shot those scenes.
It wasn't Harbor High School?
No, it was not.
Oh, my goodness. What a head
yeah,
fake.
But it looked like it.
Yes, it did. Huh. I so was totally.
Well, I was just going to say, when we recreated those scenes, I told the director, I said, this is so close to the way it was. It feels exactly like it was because it's a lot more affordable to shoot in Alabama than it is in California. But there were crucial scenes. It had to be shot in California, most notably the baptism scenes, because the film sort of builds with the baptism. There's a huge scene in the middle of the film with Pirates Cove Beach for another baptism, the baptism of my character. And then at the end, so it's almost like Newport Beach is, and specifically Pirates Cove is almost like a character in the story.
Absolutely. And by the way, beautifully filmed. I'm sure the city of Newport Beach cooperated with you, but it's just a picture of California in 1971. Now, Greg Laurie, when you set out, obviously studios have metrics. What did they expect this film to do?
Well, I think the first opening weekend it did $14 million, and they expected it to do half of that. And so it just kind of blew out of the gate. But we did, I'll say this, Hugh, it has surpassed our expectations, but our expectations were not low either, because we've been actually showing this film for almost a year to groups large and small around the United States. I've been at a lot of those showings, setting them up, explaining the film. So we've been showing it to believers who were getting very excited about it. So when it opened, they were there in force. You know,
is the writer of the original Time magazine story still alive?
I don't know if he is, but John Irwin created a composite character, and that happens a lot in movies because you had a lot of people that covered the Jesus movement from Look magazine. Do you remember Look magazine?
Yes, of course. No one else does. It's not my age, but yep.
So they did. They had some. He took the people that wrote the articles for them. And another photographer in the writer of the Time magazine piece made them into a single composite character and gave him this name, Josiah. So he was sort of a created character, but he represented the skeptical press sent to cover the Jesus movement. And there's one line in the film where that character named Josiah turned to my character, Greg, and said, when they gave me this assignment, I didn't want to do it. I like to cover wars. And things that matter, not a bunch of hippies and Jesus, but he said, but it's impacted me. And that actually happened to a number of the reporters that covered the Jesus movement. They saw something that was genuine and real there.
Greg, one small question, one big question. Actually, two small questions. First of all, Kathy's dad, did she live that well off? I mean, it makes it look like they've got beachfront property in Laguna Beach. I didn't think that was Kathy's background, but was her dad that skeptical of you?
It wasn't quite that luxurious, but they did have a nice home. And he was completely skeptical of me. And in the movie, Joel Courtney, who plays me, has long hair. But in real life, when I met Kathy's father, my hair was long past my shoulders and I had a full beard. I was a bona fide hippie. And when I walked in, they thought, this is not a good prospect for our daughter.
You know who's going to love this movie is every pastor who's ever proposed to a daughter of a successful family. They're going to all say, oh, I had that moment where I had to persuade dad that I could make a living, right?
And that was exactly what we talked about. When I initially approached him and said, can I marry your daughter? He said, no.
No.
And he said, you don't make enough to support my daughter. And her mom was concerned because my mother had been married and divorced 7 times. So they thought, surely we'll end up in divorce ourselves. But they, thankfully, we're just getting ready to celebrate 50 years of marriage. So,
well, that is amazing. Now, Greg, there's also a concert scene. And I'm just curious, that's probably a composite scene. The music scene in Southern California in 1971 is vast and expansive. But what was your concert venue? Did you go to Irvine? Where would you go for concerts?
Well, I was pretty young during that time. I went to something called the Newport Pop Festival. And Jefferson Airplane were there, and bands like Canned Heat and The Birds. And so, but I was kind of a little young to go to a lot of the concerts because I was still, like, I think probably around 13 years old, so I didn't have wheels, as we used to say. So I had to get rides places. So I missed out on a lot of those big, giant rock concerts. But there's a scene in the film where Kathy and Greg go and see Janis Joplin. And that concert actually happened in Laguna. Now, in real life, we didn't actually go to that concert together, but we took a historical event like that concert, recreated it, complete with Timothy Leary speaking, and had the characters Greg and Kathy go to it. So some of those are real pages out of my life. Other events were things that were happening in that time that John wrote into the story.
Now, Greg Laurie, I want you to tell people, because we've got listeners across the United States who are not Californians, may not have heard of Harvest Crusade. I gave them a little bit of background, and Dwayne gave them a little bit of background. Your career has been remarkable. Your faithful witness has been unbroken, unblemished by scandal. You have endured tragedy. You have rebounded. You have continued to build. Your son is in the pastoring business. Just tell people what happened after the Jesus revival.
Well, the movie ends with Greg proposing to Kathy and Kathy saying yes. And it shows Chuck Smith helping Greg get his church started. So what happened in real life is we planted this church in Riverside. And, you know, fast forward 30 years, we started doing large evangelistic events called Harvest Crusades. That's around the time you and I met you.
Yep.
Over 30 years ago.
Yep.
And you were doing things with PBS back then.
Yep.
And so those continued to grow, and our church continued to grow. But then in 2008, we experienced the most unimaginable tragedy. Our oldest son, Christopher, died in an automobile accident. And I honestly wondered if I could even survive such a thing, even though I'd done the funerals of so many young children over the years as a pastor. I just thought personally that this was something that did not seem like one could really get through. And, you know, and that was a moment in my life that my life is divided up really from my birth to my conversion and then my conversion to the death of my son. Those are markers of my life. I look at it before and after, but I leaned into my faith. And if God had been there for me, I can tell you I would have stopped preaching.
You know, resilience is everything. Christians are resilient.
Yeah.
And the movie is the beginning of a long and significant life that continues to go on and unfold through ups and downs, and you endure. I just wonder if you think, you know, looking backwards, you know, 2020 hindsight is backward. If it's leading up to this movie and to the time in which we live, because, you know, we got the Asbury revival. We have one at Baylor right now.
Yeah.
The Jesus Revolution is out there. What do you think?
I think that this is all part of God's timing, Hugh, because we were trying to make this movie 8 years ago. And there were delays and setbacks. And then they decided to do another movie in the place of it. And I came to a point about 4 years ago where I thought this may not even get made. And then it was greenlit, and then COVID hit. But then finally we got it done. And the week the movie came out, there's like this outpouring of the Spirit on the campus of Asbury College. And now it's happening in other places, and people are wondering, like, is this all planned? Well, the answer is yes, but not by us.
Not by us.
I mean, we just happened to come out that same week. So we're telling the story of a spiritual awakening that happened with young people 50 years ago. Meanwhile, a spiritual awakening is happening with young people right now. So I think God's timing was perfect, and we've heard amazing stories even in theaters of people coming to faith watching this movie. I heard a story of someone that got baptized in a fountain outside of a theater after watching this movie. So I think there's something special about this film that's not just a piece of entertainment, though it is that, but it's something that's moving people toward God.
Oh, it's very entertaining, but it is also driven by the biggest message, what we call the message, scripture by Jesus. It's right there, and you do such a fine job. Your acting crew does a fine job. Kelsey Grammer does a fine job, Greg. You must have gotten to know him in the course of this thing. All of them do, and I just want it to grow and continue, and, you know, it will go. How big do you expect Harvest Crusades to be this summer?
Well, this summer, we're going to be July 1 and 2, and for the first time, we're not going to be at Angel Stadium, unfortunately, because they told us that we cannot have people walk down on the field, on the grass, where they're having professional baseball games played there. So part of what we do, as you know, Hugh, is we ask people to make a public profession of faith and walk down on the field. So we're moving to Honda Center this year for July 1 and 2. But I think it's going to be really special because it's a more intimate venue. It's really big. Seats 15,000 people. We'll have 5,000 in overflow. But it's going to be we're going to kind of ride this wave of the passion that people have now for encountering God. So it's going to be kind of an immersive worship time, but also a time when we proclaim the gospel in a very clear way. We'll have elements of the Jesus Revolution film woven into it. So it's going to be very special and very unique.
I just cannot wait to hear because it's going to, we made our film, you and I did 30 years ago, and it scored a 2-share on PBS and people noticed, who is this guy? This is going to go off the charts, and I hope you stream the Harvest Crusade, July 1 and 2nd, for all the people who have been already to the Jesus Revolution or three times. Greg Laurie, always a pleasure. Follow him on Twitter at Greg Laurie. And go see the movie. Go take your friends, your family, tell your church. Go see it. It really is such a counterpoint to a culture of despair and denial. It's hopeful because it's the real deal. Greg Laurie, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Try and get back to sleep. I know we woke you up early out there in California. Thank you, Greg.
No problem.
If you head over to HughHewitt.com, you'll find the appeal for food for the poor. And I want you all, please, to remember your $10, your $100 go a long way. It's rice and beans. This is not sexy stuff. But no matter how much misery you are in your life, people without nothing, and I keep thinking of the orphanage we used to go down to in Tijuana when my church did that, and the roof leaked. And it's just been 12 atmospheric rivers, 12 huge systems have moved through California, unprecedented in the last 3 months. And they go through Mexico, too. And the people that they need their NGOs, and Food for the Poor is the best. So please be generous. $72 feeds a family of four for an entire year. Can you spare $72? Go to HughHewitt.com. Way to beat. It loads at the top. Give Food, Give Life banner at the very top. I'll be right back.
Stop Jack, all the water's
good Wednesday, America. Hugh Hewitt here, talking to you about, of course, the Grand Old Pod. News about Republicans, for Republicans, by a Republican. That would be me. Not sure that Generalissimo has a voting ID. I don't know that he's actually in it. I don't know if he can vote, so we don't know whether or not he's doing that.
I'm illegal?
Didn't say that. I don't know if he can vote. Are you registered?
Yeah, I have voted since Reagan.
Okay, just checking. Not sure that it matters anymore in California. By the way, did you bring a canoe to work today?
Close. Kayak.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I complained all bitterly through the show about this, but throughout the morning, it's just been deluge after deluge in California. I'm from Ohio. Nothing fazes me, as I said on the show. I don't care if it's a blizzard. I don't care if it's a baking, scorching heat. I don't care if it's endless rain. If you're from Ohio, you're used to everything. You're even used to sort of like giant lake storms that if you've spent any time in Ashtabula, you know what a lake storm is. All of that doesn't matter to people who listen to the Grand Old Pad. We are weather indifferent. But even as a Buckeye, I say in Virginia, when it snows or freezes, it's a nightmare because the roads are old and they're southerners and they really don't know what to do. And out here in the West, where I've spent the majority of my life, all right, 18 years in Ohio, 4 in Cambridge, then a couple in California, then 3 in Michigan, then 6 in Virginia. There's a little bit of D.C. in that Virginia time, our first year as newly married. We were in D.C. 6 in Virginia. So at this point, you know, I'm all Ohio and Virginia and 2 years in California. I've got no resistance at all. And I go from California I go to California in 1989, and I stay here full-time until 2016, when I move back and Bill Bennett retires from the radio. And so for the next 7 years, I've been back in D.C. So our D.C. years are about a decade. My Ohio years are about two decades. A frolicking detour into Boston and Michigan, and the rest of my time has been here in California. So I would gather I've got two plus 27. I've got almost 30 years. California is what, my immunity's down. My immunity system is wrecked to this kind of weather. In Ohio, you just say, oh, that rating good, fine, let's go play golf. I had no desire to be outside at all yesterday, which is good. First time ever, I've gotten up from my desk at the law school and took a short video of how hard it was raining so I could send it to my family and say, what are we doing here? Why did we move to California? We're coming back sooner rather than later. But climate change is good out here. People are getting water. So let's tell our climate change friends, let's not be too quick because, boy, it's going to be a good year for farmers, I think. You know, I've never met a happy farmer or a happy owner of a restaurant. They're always on the edge of gloom. And that neither here nor there. Let's get the grand old
every
pot.
Farmer is Victor Davis Hanson.
Right. And they're just going to grumble no matter what it is. We have to get VDH on. We haven't talked to him in a while. And we've got to find out if the world is ending this year again, because VDH is just not Mr. Sunshine. I want to go back and take a look from Sunday to here. There, all of a sudden, the presidential campaign is actually happening. Donald Trump was not arrested yesterday. I'm not going to cover that story until it's a story anymore. I noted on the show this morning, he wasn't arrested. I'm not coming back to do that story until he's actually arrested, because that could be a MacGuffin that either the former president or the New York DA invented. Or I'm going to go with the Kevin McCarthy responses. We wish him well. It's not really our deal. That's no public money is involved. And he hadn't done a Wilbur Mills, and that's a name that you'll have to look up if you don't know it. He's not in the title basin with Fannie Fox, so I'm not worried about it. And we will wait and see. I'll cover it when it comes back up. But I do know that the campaign is breaking out. How do I know the campaign is breaking out? Because we've got candidates everywhere. Mike Pence was on This Week with Jonathan Carl this weekend, cut number 19.
Well, first, let me say I'm taken aback at the idea of indicting a former president of the United States at a time when there's a crime wave in New York City, that the fact that the Manhattan DA thinks that indicting President Trump is his top priority, I think, is just tells you everything you need to know about the radical left in this country. It just feels like a politically charged prosecution here. And I, for my part, I just feel like it's just not what the American people want to see. We got real challenges in this country today, John. People are facing record inflation, a crisis at our border. We have war in Eastern Europe. The American people are anxious about the future. And here we go again, back into another politically charged prosecution directed at the former president of the United States. And I would just hope for better.
But he's calling on people to protest, to come out and protest, take our nation back. We know what happened the last time he said that.
Well, John, the American people have a constitutional right to peaceably assemble.
Absolutely, but to have a former president calling on people to protest a justice proceeding.
The frustration the American people feel about what they sense is a two-tier justice system in this country, mm-hmm. I think is well-founded. But I believe that people understand that if they give voice to this, if this occurs on Tuesday, that they need to do so peacefully and in a lawful manner, that the violence that occurred on January 6th, the violence that occurred in cities throughout this country in the summer of 2020 was a disgrace. The American people won't tolerate it, and those that engage in that kind of violence should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
But you say he's a former president possibly about to be indicted, and it's unprecedented. Aren't his actions unprecedented? I mean, we never saw a presidential candidate give $130,000 to a porn star to keep her from talking.
All right, let's stop right there. Mike Pence is being Mike Pence. And by the way, don't sleep on Mike Pence. Don't sleep on him. I read some snarky New York Times reporter saying nobody likes Mike Pence. That's not true. Everybody likes Mike Pence. Everybody who knows him likes Mike Pence. And don't sleep on him, because the idea of a grown-up who's been a governor and a vice president and a congressman and is a wonderful husband, father, grandfather, who is stable and appealing, don't sleep on him. There's a long way until Iowa. And the two Mikes, Mike Pence and Mike Pompeo, represent just sort of straight out of central casting Republican candidates for president. They're not billionaires. They're hardworking guys. They've been around forever. They've done different things. And I think what I want you to really hear there is Mike Pence being calm, which he always is. And I want you to hear John Carl pretending to be surprised. Now, John is a very good journalist and I think a fine guy. He's written a couple of good books. But that tone of, aren't you surprised? What? You know, nobody's surprised by anything that happens in American politics that involves Donald Trump. And the chattering class inside the Beltway, where I have not been since December, except for a day here and a day there, and a meeting here and a meeting there, this shock and awe and this pain tone, this look of concern, it's just nonsense. It's a presidential campaign. And what's not nonsense is politicizing a judicial branch of the state government. What's not nonsense is breaking with 250 years of American tradition that we do not prosecute our enemies when we are in office in order to make sure they don't get back into office. That's what would be shocking. But it didn't happen. That's great. Ted Cruz, by the way, was on with Sean Hannity talking about the prosecution a couple days ago. Again, Senator Cruz is still in the race until he says he isn't. So I'm paying attention to him as one of our potential candidates. Here's Senator Cruz with Sean Hannity two nights ago. Cut number 14.
Yeah, listen, the long and short of it is this indictment, if it comes this week, is absolutely outrageous. It is frivolous. It is baseless. It is a political persecution. It is not a prosecution. It is targeting Donald Trump because Alvin Bragg is a left-wing Democrat who hates Donald Trump. And legally, this case is absurd on its face. Now, it's all based on two New York statutes that concern business records, the kind of records you keep in your business. One makes it a misdemeanor to create a false or fraudulent business record. In this instance, what Bragg is trying to argue is that when Trump gave $130,000 to Michael Cohen, who allegedly paid it to Stormy Daniels as hush money, and he characterized that as legal fees, that business record was false and bogus. Now, he's got a problem with that theory, which is under New York state law, that's only a misdemeanor. That has a 2-year statute of limitations, so you can't even bring this claim now. So Bragg has a second thing he has to do, which he has to bootstrap that into a different New York statute, which makes it a felony if you create a false business record in the aid of commission of another crime. And presumably that other crime is some sort of federal elections commission violations. Now, the FEC refused to bring that case. The Department of Justice refused to bring that case. The Southern District of New York Department of Justice refused to bring that case. Bob Mueller and the Mueller investigation refused to bring that case. But Alvin Bragg is going to try to bring a case on a theory. You know, they tried it with John Edwards. Remember John Edwards, the Democrat senator who ran for president, had an affair and then gave hush money to his mistress? They tried to prosecute him on this theory. The case got thrown out of court. This is ridiculous. It is bogus. And it is pure partisan attack from a partisan DA.
So that's Ted Cruz. And again, don't sleep on Ted Cruz. And if you want to hear the best legal argument presented in the best way, you go to Ted Cruz. Second part of the senator from Texas, cut number 15.
Well, as you know, I just wrote a book a couple of months ago on exactly this topic. It's called Justice Corrupted, How the Left Has Weaponized the Legal System. One of the chapters in Justice Corrupted talks about Alvin Bragg and other George Soros elected district attorneys. George Soros put over $1 million behind electing Alvin Bragg. And you're right, Alvin Bragg has had his career in office letting violent criminals go, lowering felonies down to misdemeanors. Ironically, what he's trying to do here is take a felony and blow it, take a misdemeanor rather, and blow it up into a felony. And Let me say, to understand just how absurd this is, as you know, I do every week a podcast, Verdict with Ted Cruz. Yesterday's podcast is an hour-long deep dive on the legal issues explaining why the facts and law are utterly bogus. But let me just focus on one point. What the basis of Alvin Bragg's case is that Trump broke the law when he characterized a payment as legal fees when it was not, in fact, legal fees. You know who did the exact same thing at the exact same time? Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton in 2016, she paid over $1 million to develop the Steele dossier. The Steele dossier, you remember that fantastical, fictional piece that had all sorts of lurid accusations against Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton's campaign paid over $1 million for it, and she called that money legal fees. She did it at the same time in the 2016 presidential election. She did it in the same place in New York State, likely in New York City. And yet Alvin Bragg in a million years wouldn't prosecute Hillary Clinton under this law because he's a partisan Democrat. This has nothing to do with the law. This has everything to do with politics. But the irony is, Sean, if Bragg goes through with this tomorrow, it's going to backfire mightily, and I think the result, ironically, could be a left-wing Democrat, George Soros DA. If he brings this case and loses, and he will lose, he could end up, ironically, playing a pivotal role in re-electing Donald Trump as president.
We didn't see that indictment yesterday. Maybe it'll happen today. We don't know. The Bragg said, I can't be intimidated, blah, blah, blah. What I really like about Ted Cruz is that he's unflappable in the middle of the rotunda, and the rotunda always has an echo, and I've always found an echo difficult to work with, but he is just, he's a very accomplished Supreme Court litigator. It's not unlike my conversation with Paul Clement last week. When you get one of these fellows who have been in front of the nine, they're just not flappable with the reporter, and they don't mind the echo. I'm always impressed by that little TV talk. Nikki Haley also talking about Alan Bragg, cut number 28 from Fox News Sunday.
I think what we need to focus on is, first of all, you know, you never want to condone any sort of prosecution that's being politicized, because we know that that's just political revenge. And I think we've seen enough of that over the past few years. The second thing is the American people want us talking about things that really matter, which is the economy. They want to talk about, you know, what's happening with Russia and China right now. They want to talk about the fact that, you know, we've got to get our kids back in schools and back on track. There's a lot of issues we have in this country, and, you know, they can duke it out on that stuff, but that's just not anything that Americans are talking about today.
Now, the next candidate to comment on the Bragg Manhattan maybe prosecution is Chris Sununu, who did so on CNN on This Sunday with Jake Tapper. Cut number 22, please.
Well, sure. Look, if someone's calling for protests, you always want to make sure that they're peaceful. And we know that that's going to happen. It has happened before in long history, in recent history in America. Folks always are out there protesting what they see as an unjustified arrest or an unjustified indictment. But you want to make sure it's peaceful. We don't want history to repeat itself in overly negative ways. But so that's going to happen out there. And it's not, you can't just put it on the former president. It's our responsibility, right, in society, in our communities, to make sure that if we have something to say, we're doing it in the right way. And making sure that we're making a positive effect going forward. But it is going to be a circus, right? It is going to be a bit of a political circus. There's going to be a lot of unknowns. As you brought up, this could be a misdemeanor. This was tried, I believe, something similar was tried against Edwards, the former presidential candidate, years ago, and got nowhere. So this is untested. There's a question about the why they're doing it, something 7 years ago. It's not a nothing, but it's moving money and how he claimed money being moved between him and his lawyer. You know, there are other issues that really take precedent in terms of where this country needs to go, what we need to do to get stuff done, how we manage our budgets, how we secure the border. There's much more pressing issues of the day. It's just unfortunate this is taking the headline.
Now, Ron DeSantis also jumped in again on the, there are two cuts. I'm going to play the newest one and then the one you may have heard already, where the governor of Florida also talks about the Bragg prosecution. Here is Ron DeSantis from a Piers Morgan interview for Fox that will appear on Thursday, cut number 17.
You did a press conference this morning and you were responding to the reports, rumors of Donald Trump potentially being indicted. And you gave an interesting response, very sort of supportive of him in a way, by saying, yeah, you know, I think what's happening there is outrageous. It's political posturing by the SDA and so on in New York, and they should be focused on more important things. But you also repeated twice, you didn't have any knowledge of hush money being paid to porn stars. Was I right to feel that there was a slightly censorious tone to that, that that kind of thing is just not anything you would ever get involved with?
Well, I think there's a lot of speculation about what the underlying conduct is. That is purported to be it. And, you know, the reality is that's just outside my wheelhouse. I mean, that's just not something that I can speak to. So, you know, I hope it doesn't come to where you end up seeing this going forward. I mean, look, if you are a very strident prosecutor, and this guy's on the left, and you're not prosecuting a lot of crimes, Manhattan's gotten less safe, you're going to go after somebody on the other side for some novel offense. That just does not inspire confidence, and people see that as weaponizing the justice system. So I think it's fundamentally wrong to do that. And, you know, I just made it be known. But, who, you know, we'll see. Maybe it won't come to that. I mean, we haven't seen anything firm yet.
No, we have not seen anything firm. And Chris Sununu did go. I want to go back to Sununu with Jake Tapper. This is cut number 23 as we wrap up. Well, we got one more from Chris Christie on the prosecution that did not happen yesterday, the indictment that did not happen yesterday. Here's Governor Sununu of New Hampshire, cut number 23.
Well, again, I think there's a lot of unknowns. I can tell you, I think it's building a lot of sympathy for the former president. I think the fact that I was with coffee this morning with some folks, and there's none of them were big Trump supporters, but they all said, you know, they felt like he was being attacked. And as you pointed out, this is likely some sort of misdemeanor on an issue 7 years ago. This has nothing to do with January 6th. There's folks out there that still think this has something to do with January 6th. So I just think that the not just the media, but really a lot of the Democrats have misplayed this in terms of building sympathy for the former president. And it does drastically change the paradigm as we go into the 24 election.
But it is not a predictable change. Now, Chris Christie, the last person I'll play on this, got into the act on ABC with Jonathan Carl after the Pence interview and gave his two cents about what Bragg would do and how it would impact things and whether or not the former president actually wants it to happen. Last cut on this subject, cut number 24.
The circus continues. I mean, look, he only profits and does well in chaos and turmoil. And so he wants to create the chaos and turmoil on his terms. He doesn't want it on anybody else's terms. John, you know this. You know him well. He wants it on his terms. But look, at the end, being indicted never helps anybody. It's not a help. Now, I think that this of the three investigations, I think this is the one where people know the most. And so because they know the most, they're going to take it less seriously. I don't think there's many Americans who don't believe that Donald Trump had an affair with Stormy Daniels and that don't believe that he paid her money at the end of the campaign to keep it quiet. So I don't think that the American people probably see this as a huge crime. But the vision of a former president of the United States being processed, fingerprinted, mugshotted, you know, for what else do you expect Trump to say, as I said to George last week, than to say it helps his campaign? But being indicted, I don't think it ever helps anybody.
All right, that's actually true. You've got to be very careful. You can continue to do interviews and appearances, but you've got to be very careful not to provide prosecutors with locker room stuff, the way that sports players do not want to get into it. By the way, if you didn't hear today's show, my column on the Washington Post today is on why we need sports more and more in an age of connectivity. When the symphony of bad news swells around us every day, not only internationally, but on an individual basis. And I would encourage you to go to thewashingtonpost.com, find the column. Let's now transition to the other issues that were discussed by would-be Republican presidential nominees in the past week. And I want to start with Chris Sununu. I'm with Jake Tapper, indicating he's running. The governor of New Hampshire, as far as I know, has not run for president before and therefore may impact how much it matters. Now, what would matter is if he didn't win his own state, but John Sununu Chris Sununu is a very popular governor in New Hampshire. Cut number 20.
Well, I guess we're a few days closer, right? I know I probably, you know, all of us have to make some sort of decision as we hit the summer months. I'd love to be in a debate if we actually go down that path. I just think that'd be really fun to kind of get on stage with some of my friends and really have it out and talk about real issues, not just headlines and political stunts and all that, and kind of put each other on the line. So I think everyone will have to make the decision as we get to summer. So obviously we're a little closer there, but our message is really gaining traction. It's about competency-related results, leadership that can bring something to the table, that can work with Republicans, work with Democrats, get immigration reform done, balance budgets, you know, address all of these real serious issues that we have in this country as opposed to just living in the headlines.
You see, Chris Sununu is a very, very, very attractive candidate. as is Glenn Youngkin. And if they get in and they talk like that, the race won't be a replay of 2016, even with the former president being the dominant force on the stage and Governor DeSantis being the second dominant force. Anything can happen. Chris Sununu then transitioned, as did Jake Tapper, to Ukraine, which remains a divide in the party. Although Ron DeSantis saying it's a territorial dispute, those two words can't bear the weight that Republican candidates want to put on it. But Republican candidates have sensed that, okay, we have lost the isolationist or anti-Ukraine vote to Trump. Ron DeSantis is walking the middle line with no blank check. Territorial dispute was a weakness because it's a bad characterization of a land war with Russia on Russia's borders with Ukraine. But that's just a staffer mistake. Ron DeSantis hadn't come out and said that at length. He's not an isolationist. But Chris Sununu, nevertheless, wants to talk about what Ukraine means. Cut number 21.
Well, I don't think it's disqualifying, but this is a clear, it's not even a questionable, a clear, vital national interest to support what is going on in Ukraine. It sends a message to our enemies if we were to back out now that we're not resolved. It sends a message to China if they were to take an aggressive approach to Taiwan. It sends a message to our coalitions and our allies that we are going to be there, that they can count on us, that this we're not just a partner. This is the United States of America. We lead from a place of strength, of freedom, of courage. And we and folks need to know that they can count on us to be there. And so that, again, creates opportunities here at home. It secures our interests at home when not only we say we're the world leader, but we act like it, too.
And let's go back to Nikki Haley.
Polls, about 40.
Let's go back to Nikki Haley on the same subject with Brian Kilmeade, cut number 25.
DeSantis is completely wrong on this. This is not the time to get weak in the knees on Russia, which is what he's doing. This is the time to understand that the reason that Russia is trying to get our drones is because we've had weakness. The reason is because they hear this conversation. It's that same mentality that got us into the situation that we're in with China. We need to be forceful. Biden should have already, when that drone went down, Biden should have put two drones up there. We need to get our naval fleet back in the Black Sea. It never should have come out in the first place. And you put up a fighter jet. If you have to, you send a message to them that there are consequences to pay and that we're not going to put up with it. The last thing you do is retreat and show them that we're not going to defend freedom. Because if we don't win this war in Ukraine, Poland and the Baltics are next. Putin has said that, and we are trying to prevent a world war. It's hugely important. DeSantis is showing weakness in this way. Trump was wrong in this way. You go and you make sure that you tell the entire world that when we win in Ukraine, this will send a message to China. It'll send a message to Iran. It'll send a message to North Korea. And that's how the U.S. leads.
Now, the last bit from the clips of the week on this Wednesday Grand Old Podcast is from Governor DeSantis, because he was asked by Piers Morgan. We haven't seen the whole interview yet. He was asked by Piers Morgan what nickname he prefers from Donald Trump. Cut number 18.
What is your favorite nickname that Trump's given you so far? Is it Ron the Sanctimonious or Meatball Ron?
Well, I can't.
I think even he went off Meatball Ron.
I don't know how to spell the Sanctimonious. I don't really know what it means, but I kind of like it's long. It's got a lot of vowels. I mean, so we go with that. That's fine. You know, you can call me whatever you want. I mean, just as long as you also call me a winner.
That's it. Yeah, again, there's an accomplished group of people. And I haven't even played any Youngkin tape this morning. I haven't played any Greg Abbott tape. There's a lot of accomplished people who might seek the presidential nomination. Compare them all with President Biden. I'm going to give you two. Joe Biden versus the teleprompter, round one. This is cut number three. This was yesterday. Cut number three.
Grand Staircase Escalante. The Northeast Canyons and seamount of the Marine Monument.
That made no sense, but it's not as bad as this one. Cut number 11. It's poetry day at the White House. And here is the president struggling to get with the teleprompter again. Again, keep in mind, all those eloquent people, Ted Cruz and Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley and Mike Pence and Kristen, all those eloquent people I played for you already in this grand old pod. Listen now to Joe Biden at the White House Poetry Day event yesterday. Cut number 11.
An engineer, poet, Cuban-American, Richard Blanco, returned to a poem he wrote from the second inaugural of Barack and me, a poem, one today. It says, and always one moon like a silent drum tapping at every rooftop. And
just stop. It's too awful. The president cannot read a teleprompter. He cannot give an interview. He cannot be funny. And as a result, when you run for president at the age of 80, Republicans are going to have themselves a roller derby. No Democrat is looking forward to this. Really, they're going to try and run a Rose Garden campaign. But the president's got to be able to use the teleprompter if he's going to run a Rose Garden campaign. And he can't run a white. Listen to this. Bruce Springsteen. Last clip of the morning for the Grand Old Pod. Cut number 10. Bruce Springsteen is at the White House. And the Joe Biden classic wrestle with the teleprompter and screw it up anyway unfolds. Cut number 10.
Speaking of good things in music, the boss is here. As they say in South Philly and North Wilmington, a Jersey boy. I just want you to know, Bruce, there was a lawsuit that was between the governor of Delaware and the governor of New Jersey, and it's now a matter of law. We own Delaware, owns the Delaware up to the high water mark in New Jersey. So for all I know, I could claim you as part of Delaware before that. Bruce Springsteen, a poet, troubadour, chronicle of American life and resilience and hope and dreams, recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, along with 20 Grammys, an Oscar, a Tony, and an unyielding love from millions of fans across generations. The New Jersey kid is back on tour, approaching, guess this, 3,000 concerts around the world. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. Since his first performance as a teenager at local Elks Lodge, and I know where it is, Freehold, New Jersey, just across the river. I've been to Freehold, and I married a Jersey girl. Okay? Bruce, some people are just born to run, man. Last fall, during the White House event called A Night When Hope and History...
Did anyone really think that was clever? Some people are born. It was indecipherable what he was talking about, the high water mark. He had turned off prompter at that point. Now, contrast Joe Biden with all of the other Republican candidates or possible candidates that I played there. This is why Democrats want Donald Trump to run and win. Then they want to cripple him with an indictment and a prosecution. But they have got the weakest candidate I have seen any party nominate. And they're melded to him. They're stitched together. The Democratic Party is not going to get anywhere without Joe Biden this year and next year. And so they're stuck with him. And have you ever tried to make it up a big hill in a bad car? I had to cross the Rockies in a Dodge Dart 1972 Sport. And the Dodge Dart Sport was a fine vehicle for a 22-year-old with no money. But we did get it over the mountain. We got over the 70. And we, being Rob Guarneri and I, took that car on the road. And right after I got out of college and I was driving to California, and I'd never been west of Indiana, and Guarneri's my close pal, he says, I'll go with you. And we had a blast. But getting over the Eisenhower Tunnel, getting up to the tunnel and over the pass, then we coasted down to Gallup, New Mexico, and then the car broke down. And so the entire Democratic Party says, this is like Hewitt's broken down 1974 Dodge Dart Sport. I don't know if it's going to get over the mountain, 1972 Dodge Dart Sport. I don't know if it will coast down a while on gravity. And that's where we are in the president's political career. We're coasting downhill and trying to get to Gallup, New Mexico to get some repairs. But there is no Gallup, New Mexico for Joe Biden. It's not going to work. And I know they're counting on Barack Obama coming out to campaign for him again. But honestly, aren't you tired of him too? This could be a bipartisan exhalation of the boomers and the pre-boomers. I don't even know what we call them. Joe Biden's not a boomer. Donald Trump isn't a boomer. This might just be a sweeping away of the boomers, because we actually want the people running the country to make sense. We being people over the age of 60, might want to watch with great interest, but a new generation, the baton thing, John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, that is brewing. Generalissimo, what did Campbell have to say yesterday? Given that he's a TARP veteran, I did not hear the Grand Old Pod yesterday. Former Congressman John Campbell, a member of Financial Services when he was in the House, voted for TARP because he thought the entire financial system was going to come down. And I haven't had a chance to listen to the Grand Old Pod from yesterday. What did Congressman Campbell have to tell you?
Campbell said that there's still a lot of trouble on the horizon. He said that in his estimation that Janet Yellen was really honestly not that bright of a person. She's accomplished, but he said she's really not that bright, and he doesn't have a lot of confidence in her ability to work her way through this. He said that he fully expects Powell to raise at least a quarter point this week. If it's a half a point, the markets are going to flip out. If it's if he leaves it flat, it's going to the markets are going to go crazy, thinking that the good old days are here again. Free money's back. He had a lot of things to say, and he's going to write a lot of that up based upon what the Fed does on his call
today.
Look through the chaos.com.
Look through the chaos.com. Now, the reason I bring that up, and I will go listen to the grand old pod from yesterday so I can hear that. John Campbell was on financial services as the chair, not the chairman, but as one of the senior Republicans for 10 years. And he knows Patrick McHenry very well. And they all know the banking stuff. And Campbell talks about the TARP vote being the one of which he's most proud is the one he most hated to take because he didn't want to bail out anyone. But he was afraid that the whole financial system could come collapsing down. Very interesting what he said about a quarter point versus a half point. Richard McKenzie, the economist I had dinner with, fetching Mrs. Hewitt, Kerry McKenzie, and Richard and I had dinner on Sunday night, and we talked about the economy. Richard, very, very astute in the 2007-08, and he has a new book out, Reality is Tricky, Contrarian Takes on Contested Economic Issues. But Richard says, look, it feels like 2007. Well, he said also, Powell has no choice but to raise rates. Because 6% inflation will just drive the United States crazy, and we haven't beaten it yet.
Right.
In fact, it could get worse. This morning, the very first story I told the audience this morning, second story, the Bundesbank chief, that's the German Jerome Powell, and his name is Joachim Nagel. The fight against inflation is not over. And so Joe Biden is going to have a recession, a deep recession this year. A deep recession. And interest rates are going to keep going up until inflation goes away because inflation kills everybody, destroys everybody's wealth, makes every house more expensive for young people to buy. It's a nightmare politically. It's what killed Jimmy Carter along with the malaise speech and with the Iranian hostage situation and with the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. And Jimmy Carter saying, oh, maybe we ought to get over our inordinate fear of communism and saying, well, I've had my eyes open. That is all ahead of us. But today's grand old pod is a study in contrast. You heard a bunch of Republican candidates talking about Alvin Bragg. You heard a bunch of Republican candidates talking about Ukraine. You had Ron DeSantis talking eloquently about the nickname that Trump might give. It's begun. It's sort of shadow boxing, but it's begun. And every Republican is light years ahead of Joe Biden when it comes to communicating. Every single one. That's why we do the grand old pad. You get a pod. You can cue the music. I'm going to include this today, by the way, a free edition of the Grand Old Pod over at my highly concentrated queue. Just remind people, if you sign up for the Grand Old Pod by signing up for the universe, you get this every day. I host Monday and Wednesday. Dwayne hosts Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. John Campbell's in on Tuesday. Lilacs is in on Thursday. Ed Morrissey is in on Friday with Dwayne. We want to make sure that with all the noise out there, you get the substance. And so once a day, if you're a member of the universe, not only get every minute of every radio show commercial free, you also get the Grand Old Pod available only at the universe, except when I put a teaser for those of you who listen to the highly concentrated Hugh show to give a listen why you ought to subscribe to Universe. Thank you so much, Adam. Thank you, Jacob. Thank you, Generalissimo. I'll talk to you tomorrow, Thursday, on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn. deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.